Hey guys, before we get started with the podcast, I have a question for you. Are you frustrated with injuries? Do you have nagging back injury that you can't shake, or does your knee flare up every time you squat heavy? If this is you, listen up. I wanted to let you know that my long-awaited second book is finally available for pre-order. It's called Rebuilding Milo, The Lifter's Guide to Fixing Common Injuries and Building a Strong Foundation for Enhancing Performance. I wrote it to be the ultimate guide and solution to the struggles you have with injury and pain that we develop in the weight room. So whenever you're done listening to this podcast, I want you to go and pre-order my new book, Rebuilding Milo, on Amazon.com or whatever bookstore you buy from. If you're overseas and can't get Amazon to ship to you, go to bookdepository.com. They'll have it. They can ship. I want to let you know the book is officially releasing January 2021, and it would mean the world to me if you would pick up this book. It's going to be amazing. Thanks, guys.
Class is in session. You're listening to Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horshick.
Let's go!
Now, let's start the show.
Hey, what's up, podcast listeners? Thank you so much for checking out today's show. This is episode 102 of the Squat University podcast. The goal with each and every one of these shows is to bring you as much value-packed content to help you move better in the gym and in life, decrease your body's aches and pains, and help you reach your true athletic potential. Today's podcast is sponsored by Barefoot Athletics. Here's the deal. If you want to lift big weights with great technique, you need the right shoe. And for those of you out there that like to lift in a flat sole shoe, like a Chuck Taylor, you need to check out the Ursus shoe by Barefoot Athletics. They have a super wide toe box that allows you to naturally splay your toes out and use your foot like it was designed. No more cramming your foot into a narrow toe box and smashing your foot into an unnatural position. And yes, most Chuck Taylors are super narrow. I've been lifting in the Ursus for any of my non-Olympic weightlifting movements for the last couple months, and I just absolutely love them. They are extremely comfortable, and they are not going to break your bank like many other lifting shoes on the market out there. If you go to barefootathletics.com, and that's B-E-A-R, like the animal, and use the code SQUATU, you can get 10% off your order. And that's for anything on their website, the Ursus shoes, and also one of my favorites, the correct toes that can help realign poor feet and help improve your foot stability and foot strength. So check out Barefoot Athletics. You will not be disappointed. Now, today's episode is a very special one. I got the opportunity to sit down with Gray Cook, the founder of Functional Movement Systems, the famed FMS test, and the author of the book Movement. Now, when I think of my top three most influential people on the way that I approach treating patients and fixing athletes with movement problems and injury, Gray Cook is right up there with Dr. Stuart McGill and Kelly Starrett. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy today's episode. Without further ado, let's get to today's show. Gray, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on the Squat University podcast. I'd have to say it's truly an honor to have you on. Just for the listeners out there who may not know of your work, your book Movement was by far one of the most impactful books on my early career. I remember reading it back while I was going through physical therapy school, and it just completely changed the way I look at the body. I would say for those out there who don't know of the book Movement and the work that you've done, I'm sure there's maybe a few here and there, the large majority of people have at least heard of the FMS. Could you give us a little bit of a background into who you are and the work that you have done?
I'm a dyslexic redneck from Virginia. And I said that in my Google talk. So if anybody wants to see a long form of my history, I did one of those talks at Google, which is like a long form TED talk. And the reason I was out there is one of the higher ups at Google thought I had an engineering background because of the way we did the movement screen, or the SFMA, our medical version of the movement screen. But basically, I was a high school, not impressive athlete. I was a discus thrower, football player. I realized that most colleges probably wouldn't pay me to play for them. So I decided to just leave my athletic career behind and try to become an academic All-American, which was not wise, but I tried to do that and got a bachelor's degree in sports medicine, concentration in athletic training, minor in psychology. And I happened to get lucky enough to get into the University of Miami. but it was like by the skin of because I got accepted as an alternate. I was one of the youngest ones accepted. I had 7 days between graduation and University of Miami Gross Anatomy. Wow. In the summer. And so I was put on a fast track of academia with University of Miami because they were one of the first master's programs that was leading into what was going to eventually be the DPT. And so I graduated with a degree in physical therapy and my strength conditioning certification the same year. I was becoming a CSCS and a PT at the same time. And it wasn't my own idea. The guy who was ahead of me in school, a guy named Pete Dreyevich, who was Greg Norman's physical therapist back in Greg Norman's day and is right now working quite a bit on the both conditioning and rehab end with the Jaguars. But Pete Dreyevich was ahead of me in school and said, you'd be stupid not to learn to speak strength coach. We both knew we would never get to function autonomously as a strength coach.
Yeah.
But if we could at least speak strength coach and we both had athletic development in our history, it would probably make us a double threat in many situations. When I graduated in 90, I realized if you wanted to be a sports medicine guy, it wasn't what I thought. I wasn't preventing surgeries. I was just on the other end of a conveyor belt and mostly knees and shoulders. So in when I graduated, Gary Gray's work was new. This whole closed kinetic chain, put your foot back on the ground, dummy, quit kicking the air thinking you're going to get strong. But we had these unbelievably automated devices that would give us quad hamstring rotation. So what we did is we lost a logical functional appraisal to grab greater clarity. And that's a photography term. Most people don't get their focus right. They zoom before they focus. Don't confuse the two. Zooming in on subject matter does not give you clarity. It just makes you closer and allows you to see less. But
I like that analogy.
Yeah. And when I finally decided, man, I'm a University of Miami. I'm a strength coach. I got to do a sort of a internship with the guys who run the Heat and the guys who run the Dolphins. I'm ready. I realized that the pinnacle of sports medicine at the time seemed to be go find a doctor like Andrew, stand next to him and be his physical therapist and therefore be anointed the golden child of rehab, you know, or whoever your prize doctor was.
Yeah.
But I also thought there was this counterculture that I had briefly been exposed to called manual therapy. And it went back to the roots of non-surgical orthopedics, a guy like James Syriax, who was, you know, the sort of the godfather of non-surgical orthopedics. But if you go one step deeper, you have osteopathy. You can't discount the contribution chiropractic has made. And then you've got physical therapy, but there was something different in the people who dispensed modalities and the people who could do thrust manipulations at the time. And I'm like, well, one is dusting crops and one is flying jets and I want to be Top Gun.
Yeah.
So I went up to Canada and I started taking all the manual therapy courses that were simply not available to me down in the States. And when they found out I had the exercise background I had, I was trading courses. I was teaching closed kinetic chain, lower body, you know, conditioning, doing a lot of stuff with the bands and things like that, showing them how to more functionally rehabilitate an ACL. Because if they thought the gold standard of ACL rehab had Kincom, Biodex, or Cybex in front of it, they were missing the boat because we weren't even doing that anymore. Learned all my manual therapy skills, got introduced to dry needling, but knew I couldn't come back down here and do thrust manipulation, cavitation manips, or dry needling. And I just started practicing under a guy in Illinois called Paul Hughes, who actually worked under James Syriax. So I'm one generation removed from that scrutiny, and he beat me up like boot camp for 3 years. And he's not apologetic of it in the least. But I watched this guy do systematic evaluations, never assume anything, and simply deconstruct physical movement cases, not into convenient solutions, but the best attempt at the truth he could. And I'm like, that's the guy I want to be. And one day he pulled me aside and he goes, you're ready. I'm like, why? He goes, you can stay here as long as you want, but you can fly. Get out of the nest, go do your thing. And I came back to the East Coast, became the director of two clinics, and was maybe the fifth person in Virginia to get orthopedic board certified. When we did board certification and I started lecturing basically on the gray area between where rehab ends and where conditioning starts. And I was teaching functional exercise courses with a guy named Mike Voigt on the rehab circuit lecture tour. And, I had this catharsis moment when I realized, oh my gosh, we're teaching functional exercise. What's the functional standard? If we were dispensing eyeglasses, we would start with an eye chart and digress into more specific tests. If we were doing cardiac rehab, we would start with respiratory rate, resting heart rate, and blood pressure. Where do we start when we are doing functional exercise? And if everybody in the room has a different functional standard, you don't have a starting place. Therefore, you don't have a baseline and a feedback loop. And that's where the movement screen came from. And most people know me because of that. So,
yeah. So when did you actually start forming together the movement screen? How did that come about that you actually were able to put together these specific tests? How did that sort of interplay at the beginning? How did that come about?
Starts on a Delta airline flight.
Yeah.
I got called because of some of my contacts as I was a problem solver, but most people looked at me like a savant problem solver. They didn't realize that being dyslexic as a kid, but growing up on a farm and having to be resourceful because you can't write a check every time something breaks, that I was basically creating algorithms for non-failure strategies, not success strategy. Now think about this for a second. If you're trying to predict something, failure is easier than success. There's too many variables to success, but I do know bottlenecks, right? Yeah. That will keep you out of the loop. Mm-hmm. So what I try to do is look at the physical barriers to acquiring any skill or movement pattern. And so if you look at how humans move, much of our movement decisions are subconscious. Mm-hmm. Okay. Therefore, if we're making movement mistakes at the subconscious level, why do we persist in coaching them consciously? Now we can give you advice, but it's not running in the background when you're putting a bag of dog food in the back of your car.
Yeah.
So you're going to make bad biomechanical decisions, not in my presence, and good ones in my presence with my help. How's that learning? Right. Sure. So I realize there needs to be a motor learning component far beyond biofeedback and repetition. There just needs to be something. So if I got a kid that's not reading well, the first thing I rule out is a visual problem. Mm-hmm. If I got somebody who's not squatting well, the first thing I ask them is, did that hurt? No, it didn't hurt. Then I start worrying about why they can't squat, mobility, stability, or whatever. But as long as it's a provocation, I don't even worry about discussing it because pain affects movement patterns in inconsistent and unpredictable ways. So trying to motor learn in a painful environment is like throwing shit against the wall and hoping you get a nice piece of artwork. It's never gonna happen.
So that'd be why during the FMS, for the listeners that may not know about it, you have the three or four different technically categories, 3, 2, 1, and 0. And if that person scores a zero, meaning that during a body weight movement, they have pain, your first thing is, all right, we're done with this. You need to be checked out.
We are. And I want everybody to understand, I'm not trying to get more business for you or me as a physical therapist. I was absolutely disgusted by the fact that a big part of my career, I was being paid to work on preventable problems. Had you asked me 3 weeks before this happened, mm-hmm. I would have told you not to do that, or your state of readiness doesn't cover the check your body just wrote. So I felt basically that I was doing a disservice waiting on an injury to happen on the football field when I could prevent it in the weight room or in a preseason talk about sleep, rest, and regeneration, mm-hmm. you know? So I was flown out to a university to look at an athlete that was a projected to be one of the fastest kids in the country at the time. Mm-hmm. And he had osseitis pubis, or a thing called pubalgia. Now you want to fast forward to ESPN speak. That's a sports hernia these days.
Yeah.
So a lot of people who have groin pain get lumped into a sports hernia category. And just for your listeners, it's not a hernia at all, because when you do the surgery, you don't repair anything. You release a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we used to treat tennis elbow by releasing the muscles that were hurting. Mm-hmm. We still aren't quite sure that releasing these muscles is the first order of business that we should do. Mm-hmm. So this kid had ripped his adductors and abs off his own pubic symphysis,
wow.
had them reattached, and then did it again. and had them reattached. And all of a sudden, we got some D1 strength coaches saying the athletic trainers let this slip by. And we got the athletic trainers saying, no, you guys did this in the weight room. I didn't know what I was coming into. But when I get there, I'm in one of those D1 team rooms with the theater seating and almost everybody on the sports medicine staff that's trying to either cast blame or hide.
Yeah.
Standing here with a kid in his tidy whities. And I started with ankle mobility. And there were some physicians in the front row that says, hey, dumbass, don't you know the guy's pelvis is hurting? What are you looking at his ankles for?
Yeah.
And I'm like, everybody in the room knows what hurts. I'm like, who's going to go head to toe? I feel qualified to go head to toe. And all I'm going to do is exercise what the ivory tower of physical therapy agrees with, which is regional interdependence. That means a body part not bothering you could easily be the biggest part of the body part problem that's hurting you. So what you point at and what the problem is, I never see those as the same thing until I agree. And I owe you that responsibility because it's your job to point at your head when it's on fire, right? It's my job to find out where the fire is coming from. And what I realized is, you know, I think we practice upstream medicine in almost every other part of physical care except orthopedics right now. We're more than willing to lead with surgery and offer rehab as a consolation if, you know, if things don't work, but are we scared that rehab might work if we try that first? But too many people, you know, it's so convenient to do surgery right now. And surgery is so unquestioned by most insurance providers because of the political clout of pharmaceuticals and the artificial joints that I promise you we won't be using 10 years from now.
Very true. Yeah, the amount of people that I still get to this day, and I feel like I should be more optimistic because I feel like there's more of this change coming. I mean, seeing, you know, everything that Shirley Saruman was doing and then, you know, Stuart McGill, and then I see you and then Kelly Starrett, and I've been starting to continue that preaching, and I feel like there should be more of a change. And then I'll get someone that's saying they went up the road to a doctor and they had shoulder pain, and the first thing they did was look at the shoulder. They may not even touch the shoulder. They'll get an MRI. They'll say, well, this is torn or this looks inflamed. Let's try this surgery. Or maybe you'll do physical therapy after. And if you do go to physical therapy before, it's usually directed just at the site of symptoms. And they don't even look at any other things that may be contributing. And then they wonder that, you know, why their symptoms don't go away. Or if they do go away, I know one thing you wrote in your book was that the number one risk factor for a future injury is a previous injury. And oftentimes we just automatically assume we're like, oh, okay, well, maybe that area was hurt before. It's more set up for a future injury, but we don't take a step back and go, well, maybe that's because as a medical society, all we're doing is treating symptoms. We're not addressing the underlying cause. And for that reason, anyone doesn't take to a skilled clinician to take pain away. And once that pain's away, we assume that we fixed the underlying risk factor. Then as soon as that person goes back to whatever sporting functional daily life that they're doing, it's just a matter of time until that area becomes injured again, like that kid who, you know, just continued to injure his pelvic region. It's because they weren't addressing it.
I basically found a dorsiflexion restriction 20 degrees tighter than the other side.
Wow.
A torn peroneal and a small tear in the soleus. The kid had horrible single leg stance. And if a kid named Phil Plisky had existed at the time, the YBT, the Y balance test, would have proved my point. Gary Gray could have proved my point. Kelly could have seen it across the room, and so could you.
Yeah.
But the kid had had two surgeries. The problem had been focused and isolated on his pelvis, and I don't see how that pelvis can feel better in the presence of the same ankle that caused the problem. And you want to know how I know how the ankle caused the problem? Because there was a very popular thing back then where we would take people and put them on a high-speed treadmill. Okay?
Okay.
And they would run. And there's things about running up a hill that are very productive for building strength because you've got to pick your knees and feet up. As a matter of fact, way back when, a guy named Walter Payton, after he'd done football practice, still ran up a hill because the hill is unforgiving. If you don't pick your feet up, you got a face full of dirt. So if you want strength and form and technique, run up a hill. And when you want to add neurological stress and speed to that, run down a hill. Cover the get the strength and alignment, cover the momentum, get the strength and alignment, cover the momentum. What they did with a high speed treadmill without screening somebody before they put you on it is if you don't have dorsiflexion, assuming that that's not going to stress your ankle more. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's squatting on one side of your body. And so running with an asymmetrical ankle either hurts the ankle or creates a kinetic problem up the chain. And if you're one of the fastest kids in the country, you will basically do what Stu always identifies is you can't spare your, you got to spare your spine. You can't sacrifice your spine. Well, your spine becomes your sacrum and your sacrum becomes your pelvis. So this kid basically was over rotating on one side to cover the ankle that nobody picked up before they conveniently put the fastest kid in the country on a speed program. Now let's be a strength coach for a minute. What's the one thing he don't need? He can already outrun 99.9% of the people that are going to chase him. Do you think you get to take credit for making him fast? He arrived fast.
True.
All you can do is make him slower. Yeah. So you could have worked on flexibility, upper body symmetry, head and neck control, breathing, recalibration, rest and regeneration. But really, speed? He's the fastest kid in the country. Don't screw it up is your job, not make it faster. It's like when somebody hits a 500-pound squat, but that's not even their sport. They're a shot putter.
Yeah,
oh, we got to go for six. No, you got to go for a gold medal, and I don't know if 600 pounds will get you there. So.
True. Well, and I can't remember who said it, but they're for a field athlete, the idea is you don't win in the weight room. You win on the field. So just because you can bench press a house doesn't mean you're automatically going to be a better football player.
Yeah, well, and when you're in one of those weight rooms that likes to post the names on the wall, they ain't the same names that are in the starting lineup. So, but it's okay. It's okay because maybe they're using the weight room to attain that starting position. But but you'd be surprised on the other side of professional athletics with some of the strength coaches that I admire most. They're economists, man. Mm. Mike Boyle. John Terrien from the Colts, they're economists. And what do I mean by that? They realize that time and energy is a precious resource. And every year, the strength coach is going to lose more of that real estate to media opportunities, to sports medicine opportunities, to whatever else the team needs. And so physical preparation takes a back seat many times. And you've got things like the collective bargaining agreement where people maybe once at one time abused the way we made athletes train. So now it's going the other way and they can only be here a certain amount of time. Well, you got to make major changes. So clinically speaking, I've always been the guy that says, listen, before you offer up the positive, you must remove the negative. Okay.
I like
you
that.
Can suggest green tea and flaxseed to anybody you want, but if they're smoking cigarettes and drinking bourbon, they get way more well quicker by stopping those two things than they do by starting these two things. And people won't hear it. You can suggest stop doing these, start doing these. And if you give most people that advice, they will not hear what you said stop, but they will gladly add what you said do, right?
Mm, definitely.
So as a clinician, I usually see if this person has the ability to stop a behavior before I really go deep into correctives, knowing that I don't have enough corrective time to fix an OCD running program or somebody who's insist on going overhead when I've given them 2 weeks of, you know, opportunity not to go overhead, not to lose strength, but maybe not tear your rotator cuff in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. I know that goes into saying, like Stuart McGill would always say, when it comes to treating back pain, it's not only what you do, but what you don't do that makes the ultimate decision as to whether or not you get out of pain or you stay in pain. I mean, if you have someone that has a flexion intolerance, yet they just continue to bend forward at their spine and don't move about their hips, no amount of corrective exercise, learning how to brace and stabilize your spine is going to help because you just continue to push into your trigger. And I think that also goes into saying it's not a good idea to add strength and speed on top of dysfunction. And I always remembered one of the most impactful things from your writing from the book Movement was the idea of the performance pyramid and how it's the three-tier pyramid of functional movement that sets the stage for strength and performance and then setting the stage then for things like skill acquisition. And it just made total sense to me because if you look across the athletic spectrum on how kids are sold different sports today, how to train for them, you never see a movement course. You see a skills course, right? You see, I want to bend it like Beckham if they're a soccer player. Let's get your 40 time if you're a football player. But you never see a let's learn how to move better. And it's right. Obviously the idea is, you know, we so much value and place our value in performance and skill, things that we can measure and get ourselves on SportsCenter's top 10. But at the end of the day, we end up just flipping our performance pyramid upside down. And then the next time something comes through, like putting yourself on top of a speed treadmill, you know, and not your body's not prepared for it, your performance pyramid just topples over. And I know, who is it? It was Louis Simmons. He always said, a pyramid can only be as tall as it is wide.
I've heard you say that. And then, but I think that's a brilliant quote, because that quote came across my desk, and you're absolutely right. And just for your listeners, we've created a healthcare movement screen. Mm-hmm. All right. Or a SFMA, a selective functional movement assessment. I'll go into that. Yeah. We created a functional movement screen. The functional movement screen has no illusions that some of these positions, because we're going to put you in 7 different positions. Mm-hmm. There are 2 positions that are done as a unified single unit, and that's the push-up and the squat. Mm-hmm. And the rest, the other 5, are actually done in a unilateral appraisal. And some of that came from a military researcher named Knappich, who went back to the 80s and started looking at the beefed up running shoes, because shin splints and boot can't go hand in hand. Ever since we, you know, the modern military, we've had that problem. But we didn't used to have to screen people, and I can tell you why. Prior to Korea, the deep squat was a natural shooting position that was taught. Imagine sitting all the way down ass to grass and shooting left or right.
I've seen a picture of that. Yeah.
There you go. Now, we deleted that position the minute we had the majority who couldn't squat as opposed to the majority who could. Because if you happen to be a kid that couldn't squat pre-1930, you were probably born with some type of congenital back deformity, because most of America was using outhouses in those days, and they had different level seats and stuff like that. Either way, the squat didn't used to be a problem. Why? We didn't have that many footwear choices, and we had to move a little bit more. And so the squat never eroded. But so the minute we can't cover a position, it's modern society's thing to say, oh, well, that's not normal. And right now, I hate to say this, but having appropriate, BMI is not normal right now. If you have appropriate BMI, you are in a minority. The majority of the US is considered overweight or obese, but the overweight category just got smaller because the obese category just got bigger. It's going the wrong way. But you look back in history and you start seeing that function wasn't a problem. Covering mobility and stability, covering your own body dimensions in a body weight pattern wasn't an issue. So there never needed to be a functional movement screen. There just didn't. But the functional movement screen has 4 categories that get assigned one of these 7 movement patterns. It hurt you, meaning you had discomfort going in and out of it. A lot of people say, Gray, can you please describe discomfort? And I'm like, consider it like a stretch. If you hold a stretch that's appropriate, it'll get better. And if you hold yourself in a painful position that's not appropriate, it'll get worse. And if you need that kind of definition, then when in doubt, assume and let a healthcare professional tell you. But if you've got pain on one of these patterns, there's one I can't tell you the answer, because I don't know if bad movement is driving pain or pain is driving bad movement. Bad question to ask. What I will do is look at all your other patterns and see how many problems I see that don't have pain. And what I would say is, why don't you ask me why those are bad instead of asking me why this one's in pain? Because if you've got bad ankles and no internal rotation in your hip, just do a number of squats, your low back's going to hurt. You've got no other choice. Your low back's going to hurt. And it doesn't mean you got a low back problem. So the movement screen is a little bit harder version of a movement test than the SFMA. And we score the movement screen 0 if you have pain. Why? Because you can't factor anything by 0. They're not a fitness, wellness, or functional problem. They're a healthcare problem until a healthcare professional says they're not. And that's me being as close to Hippocrates as I can. I will do no harm. And telling you that painful movement within your normal range of motion is okay because you're 40, or okay because you've been sitting all day, is me basically not doing diligence in what I was trained to do. Mm-hmm. The next level is you can't cover the biometrics of the test. Okay. Now, there's a certain line on the eye chart. If you can't read it, you can't get a driver's license.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're a bad person. But it means if we let you drive, you could very easily be thought as one because you're getting ready to do something to an innocent human. So when I say in the movement screen, from a simple motor learning standpoint, you have an incompetent squat, that can injure you. It could hurt your feelings, right?
Yeah.
But what it means is if we all had to squat right now to save our lives, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Better to flunk a test than life. And if you've designed a life that will never require a deep squat, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But we find that loss of a deep squat demonstrates a lack of adaptability. You don't have as many options to adapt to the next new environment as somebody who can deep squat.
Yeah.
Now, there's a flip side to that. Many people we see have a great deep squat, but not because they worked on it and not because they're functional, because they were born hypermobile. And coming from the sport that you've been successful in, we see a lot of hypermobility in swimming, gymnastics, and Olympic weightlifting. Not powerlifting, Olympic weightlifting.
You have to be, so if you want to be easy. An accelerated in that, you have to be extremely mobile. You don't see many stiff people reach it to the Olympics.
No. And so you know, the overhead deep squat would not be the signature of the functional movement screen, nor would it be the sort of pinnacle of our test. Had I not become a USA weightlifting level one coach in Peoria, Illinois in about 1993, a guy named Mike Gatone was you know, Mike?
Yeah, that's who I think did my coaching course for my USAW in the same area of Illinois. And a few years later, it was 2006, a couple guys from my weightlifting team, the Iron Dogs from up at Truman State, we drove all the way from Kirsten, Missouri to Peoria to take our test.
I was in Decatur, Illinois, working with Paul Hughes, saying, if I really want to test my fighter pilot ability, if I can fix a back that can do that, I can fix any back on the planet. If I can fix an elbow that just hyperextended like that, if I can fix a guy that strong with a spondy, I can fix anything. And so I did it because I never learned how to Olympic weightlift in high school. And by the time I got to college, I was just weightlifting to burn off tension. So I was probably bodybuilding more than I was doing anything else just because I was training for spring break like everybody else does. But when I got to University of Miami, I had a year of eligibility left and I was a discus thrower and they could use a three discus thrower, but I realized they were exploiting me till the two guys bigger than me could outthrow me and then they're going to kick me off the team. But I started to appreciate Olympic weightlifting. Yep. And so when I got my first breath of fresh air as a young therapist, I said, I've been out of strength conditioning now for far too long and I'm becoming an orthopedic joint jockey. I want to get back where the sweat is. And so I said, you know, just like CSCS, a glimpse into USA weightlifting gives me access to some athletes. And so I volunteered to go to meets as a sports medicine guy, just helping out where I could.
Okay. Yeah.
And developed a relationship with Mike Gatone. Well, lo and behold, he's one of the assistant strength coaches for the Bulls back in the day. And I fly in to teach them the movement screen. And my daughter, Jessica, was saying, Dad, have you seen that Netflix thing, The Last Dance? And I'm like, I was there. Oh, that's so awesome. I mean, I was in the room.
Yeah.
I'm not responsible for anything that happened, but I was teaching the Bulls the movement screen in the exact same era that Phil Jackson was appreciating yoga and breathing and getting function on basically putting one of the oldest teams in the NBA on the floor and still taking a championship.
Yeah.
So Mike Gatone, we reconnected as a strength coach. He's back with US weightlifting now when it was refreshing to talk to him. But when I saw the few guys in the room that could broom handle an overhead deep squat, I could do it. Mm-hmm. But it's because I was a hypermobile guy, not because I could do it that well. But what I used in my physical therapy and sports medicine training is I immediately took my Olympic weightlifting straight bar stuff and started doing one arm cleans, push presses, and snatches with a dumbbell because I was on my way to getting a contract with Reebok when they had like some tennis players like Andy Roddick and Venus Williams. And one of the things we do for shoulder strength is we push press negative down. It's one of the best rotator cuff T-spine packages we can do. And usually you'll find that if it, I need it so heavy that your tricep only has to do the last 20 degrees. That's how much leg I need in this, but I want you to negative the whole thing down. And then when I got into kettlebells, I saw Pavel had taken that technology to the next degree. And so unilateral Olympic style lifting to me is actually the functional alternative or even the corrective I use for people who can beat with a straight bar. But believe it or not, I never do a lot of Olympic lifting with some of my baseball, golf, tennis, QB players, but they can easily understand the kettlebell. You know, there's just reasons we don't go overhead and we don't go overhead symmetrically with somebody who doesn't need that, but it doesn't mean we don't appreciate an explosive lift as opposed to overdoing strength training. So,
And I definitely have been getting more and more into kettlebell training the past like year or so. Just learning from all the guys over at Kettlebell Kings, they've got like a ton of free information for everyone out there for how to learn the basic movements. But for the past decade and a half, I was only straight bar Olympic lifting. That's all I ever did. And when you do that, I think you can develop a lot of, not necessarily asymmetries, but weak links in your functional movement approach because you're only ever grabbing the bar with two hands. You're only ever doing a straight bar lift. And then you're asked to do a single arm kettlebell swing. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, my left arm is much harder to rotate and lock out that snatch than it is on my right arm. So it was really, really interesting just to make that transition into kettlebell training a little bit and how easily available it was to sort of show those gaping holes in functionality of the body and your ability to stabilize on single arm.
The myth of the Turkish getup is it's not a lift. It's a carry.
Oh, yeah.
A vertical carry, right?
Yeah.
And the other myth of the Turkish getup that nobody can confirm or refute is if you want to learn to lift strong things, then you need to do a getup with 100 pounds. That is your barrier to entry. Yeah. That doesn't mean you're strong. That means you're ready to become strong. It's almost like the black belt for most martial artists is the doorstep to really learning the thing. And if you can't handle getting to a black belt, we didn't want you in the club anyway. So, so what we prize in the West is a pinnacle is usually a starting point for a culture that's embraced strength for longer than us or martial arts for longer than us. And I think sometimes, you know, when we look around the physical landscape, we've got to blame the culture, you know, because exercise now, I mean, let's be honest. Exercise is a supplementary act. I'm not trying to bash exercise, but I grew up on a farm. Yeah. I lifted weights because the other football players were lifting weights, but I got stronger carrying cinder blocks and doing construction in the summer than I did in the weight room preseason. I just did.
I bet,
So learning how to use your body as a wrestler or throwing hay bales or something like that is completely different than having a handle that's always in the right place and a bench that always supports you.
Yeah.
So I've always prized, you know, looks like Tarzan, plays like Jane. Meaning,
so true,
Yeah. You got muscle, but you got soft hands, as opposed to you got sinewy structure and you got really hard hands. I know you got it that way. And one of the things that I realize is I've heard you talk a lot about the pistol or the single leg squat, another thing from kettlebell culture. One of the great books Pavel wrote was Naked Warrior, meaning if you can do a one arm push up and a pistol equally on each side, you're fine. And the very first book I did that had the pyramid you're talking about is called Athletic Body and Balance. I can't believe it's still, I can't believe, but for some of your readers that may not want to go as deep as we did in movement, Athletic Body and Balance is a self-help app that says, if you can't do this, go to chapter 3. And if you can't do that, go to chapter 4. And we revisited it because it was 10 years old in 2013. And they said, what would you change at the 10-year anniversary? I'm like, I'd add a Turkish get up and I'd emphasize single leg deadlifting more. That's about it.
That's awesome. So but, when you were coming up, continue.
No, what I was going to tell you is the pistol.
Yes.
Mike Boyle asked me one something that I heard you bring up on a podcast once.
Okay.
That you use a single leg squat almost as a screening tool.
Yes.
And Mike Boyle just asked me one day, why isn't the single leg squat in the FMS? And I'm like, you know, originally when we put the FMS together, we were going to assign reps to the push-up. And then I realized if I'm trying to screen quality, mm-hmm. it's got to be a one body weight move. It can't have reps because we're going into capacity. So okay, I understand the logic of wanting to do a pistol in the screen. Mm. But let me tell you, the pistol won't tell you what exercise to work on. But if do leg raise, shoulder mobility, rotary stability, if we go through this, mm-hmm. you'll know exactly what to work on. But if you can't peg an overhead squat, you're already going to struggle with a pistol, or you're just going to do it with your quad. Both are possible.
True.
But yeah, no, on the other side of the movement screen, to me, mm-hmm. the thing that Phil Plisky proved is the anterior reach and the Y balance is the first third of the pistol.
Yeah, that's true.
So we took the Y balance test and our motor control screen, which is an abbreviated balance test, to a strong first event where the entire kettlebell culture, most of these people can do a pistol.
Yeah.
Thinking that we were going to see pristine single leg stance and balance and symmetry. Mm-hmm. But guess what we saw? One of the things we learned from the Y balance test is even if you cover your biometrics for the reaches you should do, standing on one leg, reaching with the other leg, that's just showing your limits of stability.
Yeah.
If you still have an asymmetry, no matter how good you are, if you have a mismatched set of tires, which is what you were alluding to, doing symmetrical lift with a predisposed asymmetry only strengthens the 60-40 into a 70-30 effort.
Yes.
So I see why you use the pistol, mm-hmm. but if you do a movement screen plus the pistol, use the pistol as the gauge on your dashboard or the YBT or the motor control screen to check your work, but follow the pattern that's the sickest in the movement screen with your nutrient, and you'll see that change. And one of the beauties is the minute you find a bad pistol on somebody, they start practicing the test. If you go to a bunch of SAT prep courses, you're going to test better than you're going to fare in your freshman year of college. And that's all the SATs for anyway, is to predict how you're going to do. If you practice the test, it ceases to be the test. So we got a lot. I got some guys that practice the FMS before they go to the NFL combine. Now I'm like, it'd be better just to fix yourself, but practice the test if you want, you know,
that's funny.
But my point is, if you will look at that pistol, when we went to kettlebell culture, and we did Y balance test and motor control screens on people who could competently pistol left and right. Their favorite side, they could pop out 10 or 12. Their non-favorite side, 2 or 3. They actually had some more horrendous asymmetries. And I was originally talking about the study that Napic did that sent us on the FMS asymmetry journey. He saw more running injuries in guys in the military with asymmetries than he did with diagnosed tightness and weakness. So what he was saying is movement dysfunction can be connected to movement problems, but movement asymmetry seems to be a more robust marker than any single inability. So Lee and I decided we got 5 stations of unilateral sensitivity and 2 stations of pressure cooker. If the push-up catches you, there's a lot I can do for you before you get on your feet. And if the deep squat catches you, I don't try to fix the deep squat. I fix what's wrong in that long lineage. So when we first came out with the FMS, we saw poor deep squatting correlated with every other problem we saw on the screen. So what did we do? We went for the deep squat. We developed all these deep squat correctives without listening to the rest of the screen. But I'm like, well, what got us here? A developmental approach that says babies roll before they crawl. Crawl before they squat, and squat before they stand, and stand before they walk. Why are we making the solution different than the analysis? So we reversed it, and we took the pinnacle of the movement screen, which was the deep squat, and we put it as the caboose, meaning if you flunk everything on the FMS, the last thing we're going to work on is the squat, but by the time we get there, it'll be there and you won't have practiced it a bit because it's simply a natural expression of symmetry and mobility and stability and an absence of upper and lower cross syndrome simultaneously.
Makes sense. Yeah. I know one of the things that I've always heard people say, and I think it's often they probably haven't really read the book Movement when they make their criticisms, but they'll say that especially when you get a lot of these asymmetrical athletes, a baseball player that's played their whole life and they've got crazy difference as far as their total arc range of motion, or maybe their total arc's the same, but their amount of internal versus external in their shoulders are very different. They'll say that, you know, the FMS isn't particular to asymmetrical athletes. But really the way you're speaking about it, it should be something that no matter your sport, this is fundamental and doesn't necessarily need, or the asymmetries are going to be still normal, I guess, if that's the best way to explain it.
Well, here's the thing. If you got an Olympic gold medal and you had the flu, I wouldn't assume that infecting people with the flu would be a competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. So to quote Greg Rose from the Titleist Performance Institute, one of my good friends and one of the guys who I connect with fixing athletes, is if you come from a sport with asymmetry and you don't see asymmetry in your exam, they're not practicing enough. Mm. So let's talk about the FMS. If you got pain, it's a health problem.
Yeah.
If you score a one, that's an insufficiency, right? It's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. If you score a two, it's acceptable. C's are acceptable. I've made a bunch of them. They're acceptable, right? Yeah. It'd be nice to be better, but that's what I deserve. Mm-hmm. Okay. Threes are exceptional. Now, when I see an NFL quarterback, I usually see a 1-3 shoulder asymmetry. Internal rotation on the dominant arm costs them a very poor score on this reciprocal pattern, a double reach back, one over, one under. But on their up move on their dominant arm, they have a lot of mobility. So what it looks like is they have this horrendous shoulder asymmetry. Mm-hmm. But I expect you to be exceptional on one side. Mm-hmm. I do not expect you to be unacceptable as a result on the other.
Makes sense.
Okay. So ones aren't acceptable anywhere in the body unless we have a biomechanical reason, a pin, a plate, or mm-hmm. some other reason for it. So the fact that you are a thrower with this arm doesn't mean you can have a sandbag on this arm. It means you have to be normal on this arm. And usually training to normalcy on this arm sort of rotates the body back to where it needs to be. Now, if we look at the way people used to do this in the old day, a guy named Sam Snead, one of the most functional golfers of all time, because he could kick 6 foot high when he was 70, walked a golf course barefoot one day a week to stay connected with the ground and kept a left-handed club in his bag because when he got too wound up to the right, he knew exactly what to do. Just play a sand wedge to the left a little bit and it'll pull you back in. When I was working with a very famous LPGA professional, we did med ball throws in the opposite direction of her swing between hitting golf balls, and it made her swing crisper, where most – I mean, we've all been knuckle drag coaches, right? See something, add strength. See a problem, add strength. Well, most people would persist in only training the side they swing to. Mm. But what biological system functions better out of balance than in balance in a sustainable way? None. So you can argue for asymmetry, but you can't argue for ineptitude on the opposite side. You can argue for exceptional movement on a unilateral side. You can't argue for deficient, only average. So the asymmetries that don't seem to be nearly as profound is average above average. Below average above average will rip you in half and you'll blame it on something else, like the pelvis.
Yeah, makes sense. So that 2-3, you see that a lot, especially in some asymmetrical athletes. But that
Bolt had a 2-3 leg raise the whole time he was running. But he always turns to the left in a 200 meter, doesn't he?
Makes sense.
So, yeah, but Usain Bolt doesn't back squat heavy. So if you take somebody with an asymmetry that you're unaware of and make them do symmetrical loading heavy, you're going to compound the problem. But most European highly specialized athletes with asymmetry don't pay homage to the weight room nearly as much as our athletes do. So we've got a cultural bias toward the weight room because we got to justify the squat racks and bumper plates.
Yeah.
My point is a good strength coach should know if you're loading an asymmetry or symmetrical. And if I have an asymmetrical athlete, I'll do exactly what you and I just talked about, pistols and unilateral explosive movements, to then make them aware of the asymmetrical power distribution they're getting ready to promote or fix. Yeah. Whereas if they are symmetrical, the straight bar reinforces that in an elegant way. But if you're loading somebody with a straight bar and don't know if they have an asymmetry, you're getting ready to make it worse.
Oh, definitely. And I see that's often a big reason when I'm looking at all of my powerlifters and weightlifters, or especially, I guess, really anyone, football players that are using the weight room as a supplement to their training, in that they'll not have an issue on the field. The power lifter won't have an issue until they step in and start loading the squat. And it's because of that asymmetry that eventually, it's not that the squat was a problem, is that you were loading dysfunction, or you were loading the dysfunctional pattern, and that over time just created the small, I guess Shirley Sarman always says, the micro trauma leads to the macro trauma, and eventually you develop that pain. What other test did you originally play around with when you were developing the FMS? You said you talked about the pistol was one that you guys threw out there. Were there any other tests that you played around with when you were first putting together the original seven?
Because to finish the story, I'm flying back from the university. I'm on a Delta flight. Lee Burton, Kyle Kiesel, and all the guys were back at the clinic covering my patient load while I'm flying back in being the conquering hero.
Yeah.
And I just said to myself, I could have prevented this because I wouldn't have missed the ankle. And this entire room of people who are more credentialed, smarter, and have more resources than me missed the ankle. And now that the ankle's missed, nobody's interested that I'm finding the ankle. They're just interested that they're not the one that missed it.
Yeah.
And I just realized that the level of accountability didn't sit well with me. Mm-hmm. And Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. So I didn't have a notebook, and there was no such thing as a Palm Pilot at the time or an iPhone. Mm-hmm. So I grabbed some Delta napkins and I started drawing the positions that would have shown me the ankle without knowing he had an ankle problem. So it's easy to see an ankle shows through in a deep squat.
Yeah.
But I also had enough of a neurodevelopmental appreciation coming out of University of Miami, because as much as I wanted to be a sports ortho guy, I had one neuro professor that was relentless in making me understand that any exercise that doesn't honor the central nervous system first is destined for failure. But if you look, we've based exercise on kinesiological models, biomechanical models, and metabolic models. But no one to date has a central nervous system sensitive model. Yet look how many sports are looking at heart rate variability now.
Yeah.
We used to watch heart rate variability on people getting ready to do a movement screen. Let's say you've got a horrendous lunge on the left, right? Mm-hmm. You blew your knee in walking lunges. So not only psychologically don't you want to do it anymore, but you mechanically can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. When we put you in that lunge, your heart rate variability doesn't crash. It crashes when you watch another person do the lunge before you do it that you're getting ready to do. So your subconscious mind already knows you're done. And so the thing that's always been apparent to me is most of the mobility and stability problems we wish we could fix for our clients, our athletes, and our patients are running at the subconscious level. It's almost like me flicking at your eye and saying, don't blink, don't blink, don't blink. It's the only response they got. They got to compensate, because it's compensation is the only way to stay functional at the level they want to do.
Yeah.
And most people will sacrifice their knee so they don't interrupt how stiff your hip wants to be. But confronting that stiff hip is the only way I'm saving your knee. Problem is, if we wait for knee symptoms, we're already in a therapeutic environment, you're handcuffed, and you have a limited time to fix it. Whereas if people were as proactive with their movement as they are their dental care, they look in your mouth twice a year, right? Mm-hmm. And they get paid for it.
Yeah.
How, if you as a physical therapist could do a well musculoskeletal exam, I debated Shirley Sarman with this on a radio show.
Yeah.
We deserve yearly musculoskeletal exams in physical therapy and chiropractic. However,
totally agree. Yeah.
If we can't agree on a standardized exam, and if you do the McKinsey thing and I do more of a neurodevelopmental thing and the chiropractor does more of a, you know, a joint by joint thing.
No,
that's how we treat. The way eye doctors screen is with an eye chart.
Yeah.
Every time, all the time. So if we can't agree on a central screen, then we don't deserve the opportunity. Dentists agree. Minimum, we need to do this. Physicians agree. A general physical looks like this. What's a general, well, musculoskeletal screen look like? And most of the time, it looks like an examination for a specific problem, not an arbitrary movement appraisal. And so I said, if we build a screen, we can easily get a better exam off that. But most people who feel very confident in back rehab need you to have a back problem. But most people who feel very confident with hips need you to have a hip problem. Mm-hmm. I I see hip and back problems dancing hand in hand every day. Focusing on one won't help the other. But yeah. Understanding the driver and how they interact and the patterns that force them to behave and the ones that allow them to misbehave is where you do the thing. So I drew the deep squat. I drew the push-up. And I drew an inline lunge with an asymmetrical reach. Mm. So we had inline lunge, push-up, leg raise. I think we had shoulder mobility. I didn't have a hurdle step. We were doing a standing rotation, okay. Which is now in the SFMA. But the FMS was made with hard biomarkers because I said, if I can teach a 15-year-old lifeguard CPR as well as I can teach a 45-year-old paramedic and CPR standardized, mm-hmm. then I need the movement screen to be administered by people who don't have a medical or fitness background. You know, PE coaches used to screen for scoliosis.
Yeah, I remember that.
They weren't responsible for fixing it.
Makes sense.
So we can have a lot of people who can screen. Pilates instructors need to be screening movement. Yoga instructors, dance instructors, you know, people who are getting ready to take you on the ultimate outbound adventure need to screen. I've talked to Erwan LaCour about that because you don't realize how bad the movement is of the people that are going. And if they did, they think this will fix it. This is just going to stress it. So I came back to the clinic and I think we met two early mornings a week before patients. It was just a room full of strength coaches, ATCs, and PTs, really just beating it out. And we exported the movement screen to one of the local high school contracts we had. And it was amazing the proactivity that the coaches realized. We started saying, hey, you guys are squatting too much and not deadlifting enough. And we weren't saying squatting wasn't good. We were saying these kids can't back squat, but we need fingertips to toes tension. We need to get that testosterone and growth hormone up. We need to let them know what weightlifting is. And if we get better deadlifting mechanics, whether it's sumo close grip or wide grip, narrow foot, we'll eventually be at squats with everybody. But they need to lift heavy and the coaches ain't going to say we don't. So the squat station became the deadlift station and your mobility determined the pattern of deadlifting we did. But most of those kids, we're letting them squat a deadlift, but I didn't let them use a trap bar. They had to deadlift, drag it up your shin, son, keep your back flat. And that's what we would do. And so I could make that call from squat to deadlift. All the coaches wanted was heavy shit, done.
Yeah.
We can do that, but we're not going to do it at a movement screen. So I had the clout. If you can't cover squat body weight, we're not going to reinforce it yet, but this kid still needs to lift. He can push press all day long.
Yeah.
But the better he squats, the better push press is going to be. So we'll get the squat. Mm-hmm. By not squatting.
That's funny.
And that blows people away, but they always forget the tortoise and the hare.
Yeah.
Right? The turtle won.
Yeah.
Because so that's been our play all along. We know what's broken too. Mm-hmm. But your agenda is what got you broken. So us giving you more accommodation to get, you know, well, I'm going to keep squatting, I'm just going to use a heel lift. I'm going to keep deadlifting, I'm just going to use a trap bar, right? Yeah. That's like, I'm going to keep riding in the Tour de France. Could you hand me some training wheels?
Yeah.
You just became a non-cyclist. You're not a cyclist anymore with training wheels. But how many people don't have time to adapt, but they want their coach to accommodate them with I want to lift, but I don't want to develop the technique. And so, you know, I'll do self-limiting things like sun salutation, Turkish get up and things like that. Mm-hmm. Now, and I mean, Tim Ferriss wrote about it. He did the 4-hour body and he asked me, he said, Greg, you don't have an opportunity to screen me, but I want you to put me on the functional exercises that you think will develop a base because I'm going to hack this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, chops, lifts, Turkish get ups, and single leg deadlifts. And if you can't do a deadlift, then I'm not going to teach you a single leg deadlift. So he's in South Africa working through the functional routine I give him. And it's the longest chapter in the 4-hour body. And I think Tim says at the end of that chapter, even though he'd been through the RKC and many other things, he goes, I think I feel stronger and more put together now. And we were going functional, not heavy, but we were training postural stabilizers. We were reducing asymmetries. We were confronting chop and lift patterns and hip imbalances. And so he's got the cook chop and lift bar. And when he gets back to the States, he goes, you know, do you have somebody that can movement screen me? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, we got a guy. Where are you going to be? And he's, I'll be around Manhattan. And he goes, and I said, well, I got a guy pretty close. He can screen you. And he goes, well, is he, you know, is he a good guy? And I'm like, well, he screens Eli Manning, so I think he can handle you. Yeah. Ferris got an 18, and I promise you, I didn't have
that's the, awesome.
So I can't take credit for anything, but I promise you, knowing the way that he had been training with kettlebells and some of the other stuff I saw when I went through my kettlebell training, there's no way he's seeing an 18 with symmetry without working on it. Most people can't. So it was, I already knew the exercises that he needed to be on because I already knew the exercises that are popular that go viral and infect movement anyway. Mm-hmm. But I still think a screen is a better baseline to start with instead of just, hey, I want, what are those four exercises again? I'll just start doing those. And, you know, it's like taking vitamins and going to McDonald's. Just
so McDonald's, true. Let's just jump into the squat story. You told me you had an awesome squat story that we got to talk about.
This is the one I'm probably most proud of because my wife and I started volunteering at a small private school that our youngest daughter went to. So my oldest daughter's 25, my youngest daughter's 8, got one in between. I'm spread out way more than a man my age should be. But when Zena, our youngest, was at this small startup school, we realized that even though we love the education, the principals that they were using in school, they had not budgeted for a PE teacher, nor could they find one in the startup years. Mm-hmm. So I called Chris Poirier at Perform Better and said, I'd like to apply the Gray Cook discount to as much stuff as I can get for like $2,500. Plyo boxes, balance beams, the little bitty battling ropes, jump ropes, you know, the stuff, sandbags, little mini sandbags. Mm-hmm. And Danielle and I get there not knowing what we're going to see, but I sent some of the FMS team over there to at least modify screen, which is just leg raise, shoulder mobility, squat, or a full screen on as many kids as we could, K through 7, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about maybe 30 to 40 kids per grade. So it's not that many, but we're getting movement screen stores. Getting a movement screen on a first grader is like herding cats. But
I can only imagine.
In the name of science, the founder of the company said, y'all go do that. Anyway, so we have a bunch of kids, can't touch their toes, can't deep squat. Lot of things. And the things that the PE teachers try to fix with skipping and jumping, we just had probably 2/3 to 3/4 of the student body couldn't squat below parallel barefoot.
Yeah.
And a lot of kids, this is Southern Virginia, so a lot of kids are showing up in Crocs and cowboy boots. Not because we're rednecks, but moms don't like to tie shoes in the morning when things are running late. So you get Crocs and cowboy boots. And since it was a private school and I was working for free and they couldn't fire me, I said, everybody take your shoes off. If we can't have consistent footwear, we can at least have consistent feet.
Yeah.
And we lined everybody up on the first bleacher and we did this K through 7. Jump off the bleacher, stick your landing. Stick your landing means just don't change your footprint.
Yeah.
Well, we all know what a person with a really stiff squat is going to be. Some kids try to land on their toes because they can't even get heel flat. Most kids don't have that fluidity to just bounce and land and stick that. So every kid fell forward or backward. But instead of telling them how to do it, I always had faith that there was at least one kid that was authentic enough to do it. And sure enough, there's always one kid.
Yeah.
Well, since peer pressure works both ways, and since pattern works both ways, these kids instantly saw something they couldn't do, but with possibility. Now, Danielle and I could only be there one day a week. My wife and I could only be there. So we had 40 minutes of influence one day a week. But we told the teachers, we want you to use this equipment, the balance beams, the plyo boxes and everything during recess. And every day, we had a drill like, can we play Simon Says on the balance beam? And then we ran Ninja Warrior obstacle courses. That's all we did.
Yeah.
But part of the course makes you crawl through a tube. I get reciprocal crawling.
There you go.
Part of the course makes you walk backward on a balance beam, makes you get on and off a plyo box. And I'm not going to tell you how to get on and off the box. You'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And we let these children pattern each other. By the third week, I said, y'all mind lining up on the bleachers and jumping off? When 3/4 of the room could stick the landing, oh, they were puffed up, man. They're like, woo, we're ready for the Olympics. I walked down with a big old basket and handed every kid a beanbag, said, put on top of your head. Now stick the landing, don't drop my beanbag. Now I'm being Stu McGill, right?
Yeah.
I got function first, mm-hmm. and I'll take it any way I can get it because this activity can't hurt you. Mm-hmm. Secondly, now I want you to have spine sparing behavior, but I can't be Stu McGill. Stu scares kids. So I got to be sleeveless gray cook with beanbags, right? So I go down and everybody has a beanbag on their head. They mm-hmm. jump off. They stick the landing, but the beanbag goes flying because they didn't use their spine in an organized way. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, I got K through seven jumping off the first bleacher, sticking a landing and holding a beanbag 5 out of 8 jumps.
That's awesome.
If I went into most CrossFits and said, you can't get back underweight until you can stick a landing with a beanbag on your head.
Yeah.
Everything that you've been preaching on your podcast happens without sets and reps, but you got to be humble and you got to be aware and you got to toughen up your feet and you got to soften the life of your spine and you'll be fine. Yeah. And so if I had adults that had the enthusiasm, patience, and patterning capability of K through seven, I could help you out a lot. But the funny thing is I wanted to disadvantage myself because what you got to do Monday morning in your clinic mm-hmm. is you got broken people. Yeah. They can't jump off the bleachers and they can't do Turkish get-ups right away. I need you to find the weakest link, take the thorn out of the paw. I need to know we're medically clear because adaptation can't occur anyway. Mm-hmm. But as soon as people are medically clear, I love self-limiting opportunities. Barefoot running was consumed incorrectly. Barefoot walking precedes barefoot running. But we had people that don't even go barefoot in their house decide, oh, I'm going to run a 5K barefoot today because I read a book called Born to Run.
Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't surf a big wave because you saw Laird Hamilton do it. And I think barefoot running is just as phenomenal and a skill that requires prudence and development. So I think we're such a consumer society that we sit in the bleachers and actually think we can comment on what's going on the football field. You have no idea what's going on out there, but you can appreciate it. Just don't try to consume it at that level because it's not what you think.
Yeah. Just the other day, I had a young kid come to me. He's got some heel pain. And his mom was talking about how after they had gone to the doctor and the doctor, you know, only looked at the heel, didn't look at anything else. And she thought, well, his heel pain, it's probably because we have hardwood floors. So he probably needs to be in a more cushioned shoe all the time. I was like, no, get him out of his shoes. I was like, he needs to be barefoot more often. It was almost a surprise that, hey, you know, we need to be barefoot more often. I get made fun of because I'm walking around barefoot at my house all the time. There's never a time that, you know, you need to be in sneakers or slippers or anything like that. And, you know, just doing my screen to the kid, he had no problem with his ankle. It was all the way up at his hip. They had a huge difference in hip internal rotation. And until we actually take a step back and appreciate movement, like you always preach, you never find the issue. I remember one of the analogies you said in your book was about looking at a car that's got 4 tires with low pressure. Now, one of the tires is completely flat. But if you spend your time always trying to pump up all 4 of them because technically they're all low, you'll never really fix the main issue. You got to look at, like you said, the low-hanging fruit, fix the asymmetry, fix the big problem. And then once we're in that area where everything's maybe a little off, it's not perfect, but we can actually start doing something then. But it's not until we actually fix the flat that you can actually get out and actually start training a little bit more.
And we went one step further because we had to learn from the screen. We didn't just build the screen. The screen turned around and started teaching us because here's what it did. We built the screen. Mm-hmm. We agreed as the Knights of the Round Table, bump the elbows, we will submit to the will of the screen. And here's the neat thing. Most mm-hmm. people, I've seen so many people take the overhead deep squat and make it a one-off screen, whether it's at a kiosk or on an app or something like that. And I think there's way more marketing and business behind that than there is authenticity. It does say something's wrong if you mm-hmm. can't squat.
Yeah.
But prescribing exercise or advice based on one perspective of movement doesn't really give prudence to asymmetry and all the other many things that we can do. So when we do a movement screen, not only do we know the movement pattern we want to work on, we've scaled it for you. So if everything is bad, start here. If mm-hmm. 3 things are bad, start at the lowest one on that developmental level mm-hmm. because it's the best on-ramp. It may seem like it's going to rob time, but it doesn't because I've literally spent 2 weeks on somebody's leg raise and ankles. Mm-hmm. We get to their squat, it's already better. You see what I'm saying? So we many times we might measure five problems, but the last thing I do is talk to my clients and athletes. They got five problems. Mm-hmm. You got one problem.
Yeah.
And when I flip this domino over, we'll see how many more you got. And the thing that I think that sometimes gets lost is if we go OCD on one pattern, I still got a whole movement screen on you. So mm-hmm. if I make your push-up worse to fix your deep squat, even though you're patting me on the back and say, this is the deepest I've ever gone, not so sure, because I'm looking at another gauge that says we just overheated your car. We got low oil pressure. So by having seven independent movements appraised the way we do, I know if I'm making you worse. So what we did, we had strength conditioning coaches, athletic trainers, PTs of all different backgrounds, throwing out correctives for the movement that we found. So leg raise shows us a pelvic asymmetry. Mm-hmm. Shoulder reciprocal reach showed us a T-spine shoulder asymmetry. Push-up shows us you don't know how to pressurize your core, even in a developmental position, much less on your feet. So we had all these things. What we did is systematically deleted all the exercises, popular or not, mm-hmm. equipment-based or not, that didn't seem to change movement. And what we wound up with was stuff that looked a lot like yoga, Pilates, neurodevelopmental technique, rolling, crawling. And then when we do get into movements, more like chops and lifts and single leg deadlifts and pistols than really conventional exercise. Yeah. And, you know, so a lot of times people think they flunked the squat test, they need to work on the squat. They flunked the push-up test, they need to. What I'm playing is an inhibition card. If I can change your push-up in a single session or your squat in a single session, I'm not that good. And what just happened to you wasn't strength. It was de-inhibition. There's two ways to make a car go faster. One is to press the gas pedal. The other is to take your damn foot off the brake. Mm-hmm. And most athletes I see are pressing both pedals, wondering why they're not going faster. And if I can remove the negative, then I'll see where I need to go. And so it's very easy to get lucky on a one-off movement and say, do this movement, let's correct it. But I think that's where we were. Where we are now is I owe you every line of the eye chart. And we'll pick how we do the drill, because I'm not trying to get you to memorize this thing. I'm trying to get you to see this thing. I'm trying to get you to feel this thing. I'm trying to get you to do this thing. Memorizing the eye chart is the scariest thing in the world that I can think of, because you're getting ready to go somewhere that stats say you don't belong.
Well, like you said, the football players trying to practice the FMS so that they would look good on the screen, but not actually realizing what they were doing in the end.
No, I actually got a call a week before the combine. One of my strength coach buddies, who happens to be on the lecture circuit, and I know he was working with some guys who were trying to show well at the combine, and it was shortly after the FMS became an official station at the NFL combine. Mm-hmm. He said, hey, Gray, how you doing? By the way, are they doing the screen at the combine from athletic body and balance or the one from movement? And I'm like, they're doing the official screen. That's actually a self screen in athletic body and balance. And for the people who are listening, if you want to screen yourself, there's a lot of ways we're working on, but that book will show you how to do it. All you need is a broom handle and a doorway. And so screen yourself. But anyway, he's like, so, if it's the screen in the book, how's that push up work again? And so instead of being absolutely sure that I've got a functionally correct, well-trained athlete, mm-hmm. that understands the capacity test, right? The what we're doing. I want to see the 40. I want to see the bench press. But nobody's doing the bench press at the combine to see how strong you are. It's 225 for reps. They're doing it to see how weak you are, right? Mm-hmm. Once you pass 20 reps, they start looking away. They're just counting. But a guy with a neck and shoulder problem is not going to get through that bench press pretty. So the bench press is not to see how strong you are. It's to see if you don't make the cut. Because most people who make it to the NFL combine aren't weak. Mm. The reason that bench press is looking one-sided, or you're all trapped up on this side in your last reps, is because you probably got some neck, shoulder, T-spine, and scapular dysfunction. So if we really knew the reason why we're doing the bench press at the NFL combine, it ain't about your pecs. It's not. And we don't think the guy with the biggest bench press hits as hard, you know?
Yeah. Well, We see these athletes all the time. I know for sure in weightlifting and powerlifting that are extremely strong. I mean, you can look at any of like hook grips or videos, and these guys that are at the Olympics, and you see them in the training room, and they're squatting, but they have like a horrible knee collapse. And people always wonder, well, how does this athlete not have pain right now? Or someone will say that maybe they fancy themselves more of like a functional movement guru or something that only does corrective exercise ever. They'll say, well, they're glute medius, right? They'll just isolate. They'll say, well, this person isn't weak. They're extremely strong, but it's that they probably lack something somewhere, that mobility, stability, that's not allowing them to move in that optimal manner. So like you said, it's not that these guys that are getting to the combine, they're not weak by any manner. They're very, very strong, but there's probably something that in their body and the way in which they're handling themselves that's going to allow them to change and compensate and have that movement problem that's going to come out in that 225 test.
No, it is. And the reason the FMS became popular with the SEAL teams and the NFL and then MLB, NBA, NHL, the reason we got popular, hell, we're in NASCAR teams right now, but not necessarily for the driver, for the pit crew. These guys got to move fast, man.
Yeah.
They're athletes on the blacktop. Mm-hmm. So where sustainability and performance counts, most of the tip of the spear guys have gone upstream because they realize if me and you got an asymmetry, mm-hmm. that's not good. If a Ferrari has a little bit less air in one front tire, that's going to get compounded exponentially by the reps and the stress that goes on. So yeah. All we've really said is, listen, health is the absence of current signs and symptoms of disease, disability, pain, and dysfunction. Wellness is better defined as a lack of risk factors. Mm. Well, believe it or not, in the newest appraisal of the risk factors that bubble up for musculoskeletal injury risk, mm-hmm. YBT is 5 of those. Mm. FMS is 2 of those, and movement pain is 1 of those. Okay. So we got 8 out of 16 risk factors for musculoskeletal injury added within the last 6 years. Right? And their global movement appraisals, like you talk about, they're not isolated analyses of patellar tracking or the navicular. Even though if you can't squat and we can't fix it, I'll probably look at those things.
Yeah.
But looking at those things before you have a global appraisal of, is this the biggest problem? So I'm a country boy. Get me to the flat tire and I'll get us home and we can put air in the rest too. Mm-hmm. But get me to that flat tire. And too many people are worried either about policing perfection. The Hall of Fame in athletics is full of bad movement screens that knew exactly where their limits were. But thinking you got good movement and not having good movement is a bigger risk factor in my book than having bad movement. LeBron James does not have a good movement screen. He knows his limits and he never has to cross them, because he doesn't have to adapt. The NBA has to adapt to LeBron. But if LeBron were in a situation where he had to quickly retool, change everything about his play, he's going to have a harder time. It took Tiger Woods a long time to retool his swing because his body was a fixed entity. But as long as you're dominant, stay there. But the minute you're trying to adapt or become better, the less reason you have to compensate, the less wax you got in your movement ears, the quicker you learn. So it's really a competitive advantage to adaptation, but a risk factor happens to be if you can't cover your global movement. And I have a lot of people say, I don't need a screen. I work out functionally all the time. I'm like, that's the kind of confidence that needs to be movement screen, because believe me, I developed the movement screen. The leg raise caught me right away. The most basic test in the movement screen caught me. I had 18 fractures before I was 18 and 3 hernias and a cervical fusion. I'm beat to crap, but I didn't try to create a test I could pass. I tried to create a test that kept me in my lane because apparently I didn't know it growing up.
It's one of those things that really makes the invisible visible. And that's
exactly,
what
exactly. And we found, and we're working on new ways to really polish that exercise, but we found that most athletes are unaware. And the minute they figure out the screen is not to penalize you, but to give you a competitive advantage. When I introduced the movement screen at the Indianapolis Colts, and John Terrine said, well, let's say we just did have to fix somebody's squat. We got everything, and we could probably end with this. We got everything else fixed, and that squat's still not grooved. He said, show me what you'd do. And he had one of those Kaiser functional trainers, right? Mm-hmm. We put a straight bar across the top of the Kaiser, but you can do it with an old lat pull down.
Yeah.
If I put half your body weight on a straight bar, If it's suspended in the middle, you got to balance it out. But if it's tethered on both ends, then you can just drop into an overhead squat. We put about 30-pound sandbags on your toes, and we say dorsiflex into a deep squat. And it will help you stand up. So we reversed squatting and said, pull yourself into a deep squat using reciprocal inhibition, using core training, using PNF patterning. And believe it or not, if you tell me this guy's got no mobility reason why he can't deep squat, but he still can't put the timing together, we put half your body weight on the bar and pull yourself into a squat.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised what happened. So when I showed him that trick, he goes, that's the cherry on the, on top. That's, you know, but we went through it, and, you know, for 11 years, the Colts were screening their players. They fielded the smallest team. They had the least injuries and the most wins. Now, in that same time span, the Patriots got more Super Bowls than the Colts, but the Patriots were usually going to postseason play with second and third string people. And they had two B's that nobody's ever seen before. That's Belichick and Brady. But my point is, as a strength coach, John Terrine delivered sustainability and I think a well-fielded functional team that seemed to have less hindering problems at the postseason than most other teams.
And that's so, sustainability. That's what it's all about.
That's exactly what it is. And that's really what I want everybody to hear from this is you're preaching the fact that, you know, if you like the weight room, here's how to make it last a long time. If you like what the weight room does for your sport, here's how to make it last for a long time. And the checkup right now, because we do have a very erosive lifestyle. There's a lot of toxins out there. A chair is one of them, like Kelly talks about. But most people who think they know function are surprised by when they movement screen. And so my first intervention in a clinic or a facility when I go to do is, we're not going to bring in examples and we're not going to do case studies. I got enough shitty movement in this room for all of us to identify and do a real-time corrective, because a real-time corrective that changes movement in a single session demonstrates it's a functional problem at some level and not a structural problem. Well, I got long tibias. I'll never be able to squat. You know what I'm saying?
I hear that all the time.
Yeah. No. Okay. Well, I just either shortened your tibia or gave you 30% more squat. But once people see these things happen, they realize you can make a functional argument by showing a quick time change. Second question, how long will it last? Doesn't matter. It ain't structural right now.
There's
this much of a change. That means you have functional plasticity. You can change the way, you know, most of the problems you have with your iPhone are fixed by turning it off and turning it on. Most of the time you're running a bad leg raise app on the left and a bad squat wrap in the, you know, app in the upper body. All we do to resync your apps and your operating system is reset you. How we do that? Find the last place in the developmental progression where you're screwed up and make you start from there. And usually 80-20 play, if you stay global, they'll work through it. But usually most people are impatient and they want you to go in and dry needle their popliteus and speed things up a little bit. And we can do that too, but you got to do the work.
Yeah. Well, it's been a good hour and a half, and I need to be respectful of your time. And I just want to say thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come on the show. It was nothing short of an honor to learn from you. And we got to give a shout out to your oldest daughter, Jessica. Who hopefully
Action Jesse. You got to say Action Jesse.
Action Jesse. Action Jesse, thank you for listening to the show and for following Squat University.
And by the way, honey, I got a podcast too, but apparently you already told me which one you like better. So.
Where can people continue to find all the stuff that you put out and learn more about FMS?
I did two courses a while back, and maybe there's a way we can help your listeners get hold of those courses. It's called A Common Sense Approach to Movement. It's not a certification. It's just me telling you everything I've learned about movement since Athletic Body and Balance. And it also shows you the way I talk to athletes is what I say in Athletic Body and Balance. And the way I talk to people who have your credentials is how I talk in movement. So I wanted people to know you don't have to learn biomechanics. You don't have to teach your clients biomechanics to help them biomechanically. There's a much easier way to talk to people about movement and in a common sense approach to movement and a common sense approach to fixing movement. I simply make the case for movement screening as if I'm not promoting my brand. But what we've seen is the whole concept of movement screening we didn't just throw something out there. We started the category. And I feel a level of responsibility to say that I know there'll probably be better movement screens one day. I hope I've got something to do with them, but at least we tried to do a test that you're not supposed to practice. It's supposed to be authentic. And believe it or not, you can fix movement screens. A Pilates instructor can fix movement screens. A martial artist can fix movement screens. If you'll listen to them, there's something in your wheelhouse that is more corrective than conditioning. Try that first, or just look at some of our prepackaged recipes and try those. But I'm more adamant about people looking at the consistent baseline and getting creative than getting creative with the test and regimented in their exercise analysis. So, you know, I want people to find me at functionalmovement.com. Anything we do is on that website. We've got two books. They're both on Kindle. If you like that, Lee and I do a podcast called the Movement Podcast. And, there's like a bunch of whiteboard talks and everything, but, I'm on Instagram, but I don't know how to work it. Somebody just takes what I say and makes the words come out the other end. The funny thing.
Awesome. All right. Well, again, thank you so much. And everyone, if you are listening to this right now, take a screenshot from your phone, tag Squat University on Instagram, and I'll reach out and say thank you so much for listening. And until next time, guys, happy squatting.
That's it for today, class, on Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horschig. For more exclusive content, log on to squatuniversity.com.